We'll call the meeting back to order, the House Tax Committee. We are not quite at a quorum yet, but we'll get going here. Members, what I'm looking at today is we're going to have a walkthrough of the work that Chair Runbeck's committee did last night, and then I would prefer to put that on the bill. So we've got the bill the way we want to work on it from. It's an author's amendment, and then we'll work from there. So we do have a quorum. We'll officially call the meeting to order. Representative Carlson moves the minutes of March 14th. Any additions or corrections? All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I just have a quick question. I heard the Conway talk was that you may be meeting tomorrow, and I'm just asking, but maybe for the benefit of everybody, I happen to have a doctor's appointment tomorrow and might need to adjust it. Is that the plan, or are we going to meet on into the evening, or just
okay? Thank
just so
you.
Some of us can do some planning.
Certainly.
For adjustment of calendar.
Thank you, Representative Carlson, and just for members. What's been posted is we have a meeting, and I do want to make a change in the posting. We have a meeting right now until noon. If we get the bill out, then we're done. Then we start up tomorrow. If we don't, we start up tomorrow at 10, and I'm going to be removing the 3 o'clock so that that could go later if need be. I do want to take debate on the bill. And so, yes, it's been posted that we're meeting at 10. The change I want to make is I think it says 10 to 3, and we'll just get rid of that 3. For
Chairman,
now.
It sounds
so,
like my appointment is next week then.
Well, no, I mean, we want to make sure you're healthy and everything. So, well, if we get it done by noon today, Representative Carlson, I'm all for it. I want to make sure you can keep your appointment. Okay, so with that, members, I'll move House File 2337 as we amended it yesterday. And I'm going to have Mr. Michael go through the work of the property tax. Members, you have an A7 amendment. That's an author's amendment, and basically what it is, it's the work that the property tax committee did last night. And I want to thank the property tax division last night. They've been putting in some long days, and I certainly appreciate their work. So, Mr. Michael, go through the A7 amendment. Then be my intention to move that just to get it on the bill so that we have a basis to start our discussion from. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, what I'll do is I'll just go through the amendment and list out and describe the bills that are being added. There's a couple of other changes that are not bills, and I'll describe those. And when there are differences from the introduced bills of the members as opposed to, you know, amendments that were adopted, I'll try to flag those as well. So starting on page 1, line 3, this is Representative Fabian's bovine TB bill, which was heard both in this committee earlier and in the Property Tax Division. On page 2, line 31, is Representative Bill's bill for the Cook or ambulance levy. On page 3, starting on line 18 and is Representative Keel's bill for the flooded farms in Marshall County, making that a permanent provision. On page 3, line 24, is Representative Banyan's bill on holding property for economic development. This is a different version of it than was heard and passed by the Property Tax Division last night. It's consistent with the suggestion by Representative Mahoney, which makes it a temporary provision that grants a 2-year extension rather than permanently increasing it to 15 years. On page 4, starting on line 1, is Representative Runbeck's Truth and Taxation Tax Force provision that was passed by the division last night. On page 5, starting on line 15, is a new provision that I believe has been discussed before, that for Representative Lanning, providing a short property tax exemption for certain new housing construction in the city of Moorhead. Starting on page 7, line 2, are some technical changes to Representative Mazzarol's bill that allows for transfers of net operating losses. These were suggested by some tax practitioners, and basically there are three changes. First, it allows the purchasing corporation to allocate the tax credit among any of the members of its unitary business. Second, rather than using the apportionment of the NOL in the year of the transfer, it uses the regular apportionment of the NOL under current Minnesota law. And the third thing, and probably the most important, is it clarifies that the state's not going to impose its corporate tax on the amount that the receiving or the selling business gets for its NOL. On page 10, line 8, is Representative David's bill providing for a slight change in the allocation of the Rochester sales tax for the non-Rochester cities. On page 12, starting on line 1, is Representative Quam's bill that relates to the Rochester lodging tax, increasing the rate of that tax. On page 13, starting on line 12, is Representative O'Driscoll's bill relating to the Central Minnesota Area Sales Tax. On page 14, starting on line 21, is Representative Anderson's bill that clarifies the projects for the Clearwater Sales Tax. On page 15, line 7 is another part of Representative Quam's bill that repeals the Rochester food and beverage tax since they're increasing the lodging tax. Starting on page 15, line 14 are the TIF provisions. The first one, starting on line 16, is Representative Crawford's bill that extends the jobs TIF provisions for an additional 18 months. On page 16, line 29 is the start of Representative Nelson's bill that provided for modifications in the TIF pooling for foreclosed housing. This only makes the clarifying change the measurement of the value of the housing is before demolition and rehabilitation. It does not increase the or decrease the waiting period after foreclosure before they can acquire the houses. On page 19, starting on line 25, is Representative Slawick's Oakdale TIF bill. This is limited to a 2-year extension rather than a 4-year as was in the original bill. On page 20, line 27, is Representative Bill's bill for Apple Valley. There are modifications of this to make it consistent with the Maple Grove proposal for their similar problems. So the city of Apple Valley would be required to make similar findings to the Maple Grove findings with regard to the area where they're going to create these TIF districts. And secondly, they would have 5 years to create TIF districts rather than 10 years. On page 22, starting on line 1, is Representative David's bill, TIF bill for Maple Grove. The one change in this is that the 10 years to create districts is cut back to 5 years. On page 24 is Representative Hansen's bill, starting on line 25 for the Dakota County Community Development Agency. The extension in that bill that was originally requested was 15 years, and that's reduced to 5 years. And secondly, the authority to use increments for things like community centers, parks, and so forth is eliminated. On page 25, line 17 is the Representative Howe's bill for the Bloomington Central Station TIF. The extension, which was originally requested for 7 years, is reduced to 4 years. On page 25, line 26 is Representative David's Mall of America TIF bill. The extension in that is reduced from 20 years to 10 years. And on page 26 is Representative McElfatrick's Itasca bonding for nursing homes. This bill is subjected to a reverse referendum. On page 26, line 24, is Representative Kiefer's bill for Woodbury, and this, similarly to the previous bill, is also subjected to a reverse referendum.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Michael. This is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape we'd like, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion, but then we'll be working off the bill that is House File 2337 is amended. So I will move the A7 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Now, members, what I'd like to do, as I had said earlier, is that we would be taking testimony on House File 2337 as amended. We will open it up for that. At some point, the department will be wanting to testify. We'll certainly give the department the time that they would like to visit about the bill. And then we will, if we can get her done by noon, she's done by noon, and Representative Carlson can take care of his commitments tomorrow. If not, we'll be here from 10 till whenever tomorrow. So that's kind of a little groundwork for the agenda on this bill. So with that, is there anyone, maybe a show of hands, anyone that would like to testify regarding the bill? And we will be looking at, you know, brief testimony. We want people to get their ideas on the record, but we will go from there. For the bill or with concerns on the bill, either way, and the various provisions. Sir, do you want to come down? Okay. We'll start with the gentleman that's coming down here, and then I see we've got some folks over here that we'll want to hear from. And then we'll be opening it up for members' discussion on the bill and amendments. If you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name is Matt Socek. I work for a group called Project for Pride and Living, otherwise known as PPL.
Could you please spell your last name, sir?
Sure. Spell this as in Sam, O-U, C as in Charles, E-K.
Okay, thank you, sir. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I am the public policy coordinator and also a housing development project manager for PPL. If you haven't heard of our group, we've been around since 1972, serving the greater Twin Cities area with affordable housing and social services. We own over 1,000 units of housing in the Twin Cities area, available to families of lower moderate incomes. I would respectfully encourage the committee to eliminate the provisions that you have proposed to curtail the renter's credit. While PPL and other nonprofit developers and owners do all we can to keep rents affordable for those families that we serve, the prevalence of low incomes coupled with the high cost of living make it so many residents are paying more than 33% of their income towards their housing. This is not considered affordable. For these families, the property tax refund represents an opportunity to pay down accumulated debt, consumer debt, buy badly needed clothing for their children, and to stock up on non-perishable goods that may ride them through tougher times throughout the year. These are some of the most common uses that we at PPL hear for the renter's credit. As I understand what is proposed, the renter's credit would not be completely eliminated for those of the very lowest incomes. We certainly appreciate that. But more moderate income families, that is the two-wage earning families with very low wages who are trying to create a better future for their children, could use a hand up now, particularly in this very tough economy. Contrary to the popular myth, renters do pay taxes, pay property taxes. If we at PPL pay $60,000 in property taxes on a typical 50-unit building, every one of those dollars is paid for with revenues generated from the rents from our residents. It is fair for these folks to have a tax benefit, as homeowners do through the property tax deduction. I understand and appreciate the committee's desire to reduce taxes for businesses to create a better business climate here in the state. We certainly appreciate that, but there has to be a better way to pay for it than further erode the means of people with the least available means. I respectfully ask that you eliminate the provisions for reduction of the renter's credit in the omnibus tax bill. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Any questions for the witness? Okay, thank you very much, sir. Joan Wilshire, if you could join us. And the last gentleman, I appreciate the job he did. If testifiers could kind of focus in what part of the bill they are talking about, That'd be wonderful. Ms. Wilshire, welcome to the committee. And again, while Ms. Wilshire is coming up to the table here, I'd really like to thank the members of the Property Tax Committee. They put a lot of work into their portion of the bill, and so I do thank them.
Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Joan Wilshire. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota State Council on Disability. And I have with me a person who's going to testify in just a moment on her experience with the issue of the rental credit. And we do have some concerns and just wanted to share those with you for something for you to be thinking about. We definitely want you to be thinking and understanding that there's the population of Minnesota of people with disabilities around 20%. And so that's a huge number. And that number we come up with is through a couple of different areas, not only people with disabilities under the age of 65, but over 65, and those then, of course, under the age of 18. Typically, the number that is used throughout the state is the age ranging from 18 to 65. And so it becomes a little bit greater, which is why we come up with the 20% number. Housing is a huge issue for people with disabilities. Where you live determines many instances of you can be able to work. Can you get to your health care? Can you get to the grocery store? It's important. And, of course, looking at our budgeting and so forth, the percentage of people, there's a great percentage of folks that are on disability, on a fixed income, and cannot afford a variety of different things. And they look at the tax rental and credit as a way, means to help them meet all their obligations, groceries, extra co-pays, and et cetera. And another fact you should be aware of for people with disabilities is that the unemployment rate for people with disabilities nationally is around 22.6%. In Minnesota, I can tell you that we have employed around 52%. About half of people with disabilities are employed, and that's compared to 79% of those without a disability. So why I'm pointing that out to you is, again, our discretionary income for people with disabilities is much less, and they count on the renter's credit to really help them make it just for daily living. I want to introduce you an individual that we know in our office very well, is Liz Dembski, and she's going to tell you her story about how the rent credit, the reduction, will impact her life.
Okay, if you could please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, and then if you could spell your last name.
Sure. My name is Elizabeth Dembski, D-E-M-S-K-I.
Okay, welcome to the committee, Ms. Dembski.
I'm concerned because I'm on Social Security disability. I have a part-time job that I work 4 hours at. But my rent is over half of my total monthly income. I really rely on the renter's credit at the end of the year to cover expenses like groceries, like uncovered medical expenses, and any emergencies that come up during the year to help me through the year. And it keeps me active, it keeps me in my apartment, and it keeps me working. Other alternatives that are offered to me, like the voucher system, in Ramsey County, there is a 5-year waiting period. To get on a shorter waiting period, I'd have to go to the suburbs where there's no transportation, and I would not be have accessible transportation to work at all. And this would really be a great detriment to the quality of my life. So I really hope that you do not cut the renter's credit. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Dembski. Any questions for Ms. Dembski?
I'm just going to follow up and complete this.
Ms. Wilshire?
Mr. Chair and committee members, handing out a little bit of information, some stats. Some of it you've already seen, but it talks us further about, more about the rental credit and so forth. And we're just concerned because we're in the disability communities taking a lot of blows for a lot of different issues throughout the legislature last session, and it looks like we're going to have a few more this session. It's becoming very difficult for us just to be able to live in the community of our choice, and that's really important for us to be able to, live where we want, to be able to live where there's transportation, good community, and so forth. So I would love to you to think about that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Wilshire. Any questions for either of the witnesses? Representative Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and Ms. Dembski. Thank you so much for being here to testify. And I heard you say that about half of your income goes to housing.
Yes.
And tell me, How easy is it for you to find housing that, you know, meets your needs as far as transportation to get to and from where you need to go? I mean, how difficult is that to find even something within a price range and so forth?
Ms. Demski?
I've been working with Courage Centers for Independent Living since I turned 60, and I realized that the place, my studio apartment, may not be an option for me. They were the ones that informed me that in Ramsey County, there is a five-year waiting period. At the age of 65, it is cut off. You're no longer eligible for it. They suggested moving to the suburbs because there are shorter waiting lists. But the problems with their suggestions, like Stillwater and White Bear Lake and other outside communities, is there is not daily transportation to downtown St. Paul where I work. Also, I mean, it's different if you can drive, but I'm epileptic. I'm forbidden from driving, so that automobiles are just not an option for me. So it has to be public transportation. Finding accessible, low-cost housing near transportation is extremely difficult. And the community that I'm in is very accessible. I walk walk everywhere that I need to shopping, to the grocery store, to restaurants. And I have like a community set up there. To uproot me and put me into a suburb someplace would be really isolating and quite devastating to me.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Marquardt?
Ms. Demski, thank you so much for that. 28% of those who receive the renter's credit in this state are senior citizens or those with disabilities. And according to this bill, the average renter's credit cut for senior citizens or those with disability will range, depending on your income, from $53 to over $400. Ms. Demski, if you care, how would you cope with a cut, another cut? I mean, remember, we had one last year. How would you deal with how are you going to make up for some of those lost dollars?
I don't think I'd be able to, quite frankly. I would have to consider looking into other options. They're not, I mean, I've been looking for over a year, and I really haven't found, you know, anything quite good enough. The small deficit, you know, the small break that you did last year from the 19% to the 17%, I noticed already when I figured out my taxes that will make a difference in the next year as to how much I can save, because some of my medications aren't even covered by Medicare. And because they're not covered by Medicare, they're not covered by MA. So I have a prescription that is $108 a month that I have to have. So you're looking at a rent credit that was covering that for at least part of the time. It's going to go very fast, and I'm not going to have any kind of a cushion for, like, getting a good diet. I'll be getting much more carbs, you know, like poorer food. And since I'm diabetic and I have chronic leukemia, you're running into a lot of problems. The rent credit has enabled me to stay in my community, to stay functioning, to stay working, and also to continue to pay taxes to the state. I mean, I sure, like, my part-time job may not seem like much, but it's extremely important that I get to work, that I have access, and that I feel that I can contribute something to my community. If I were to lose that job, it would be extremely difficult. I would just be isolated in a little apartment someplace with no contact. And I don't think you realize the tremendous impact on the quality of life that this can make for the disabled and just anybody in a poor community. I mean, I worked since the time I was 16 until I was forced into disability. And it was a hard adjustment to suddenly not be working. And I really hope that you do not take this away from me.
Okay, and Representative Marquardt, I think you misspoke. The renter's credit last year was up to 19%. You said we cut it. It was the history members, as you know, 2010 was 15, 2011 19, 2012 17. And so we'd be going to 2010 levels. Representative Marquardt, you have the floor, sir.
Ms. Dempsey, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for listening.
Any other questions for Ms. Dembski or Ms. Wilshire? Thank you very much for your testimony. Really appreciate it. Any other comments from anyone? Come on down. Please state your name and who you represent, please.
My name is Tracy Goodrich, and I'm with a tenant advocacy organization called Homeline.
Okay, how do you spell your last name?
G-O-O-D-R-I-C-H.
Okay. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I am a tenant organizer with Homeline, and I'm here to oppose the proposed cuts to the renter's credit. I have been renting in Minnesota for the past 10 years, and I have received the renter's credit before myself while attending graduate school at the University of Minnesota. It helped myself and my husband get through tough financial spots, and I'm here because it helps many working families, students, and others with low incomes. As an organizer, I talk to a lot of tenants from around the state, quite a bit of the time. The renter's credit is by far the biggest issue that we engage renters about every year. I hear some of the same comments from tenants every year. They tell me things like the fact that services and resources that seniors and people with disabilities rely on continue to see cuts. Fixed incomes like Social Security are not going up. They tell me that food, gas, and medical copays and medicines are going up in cost. People feel like they're getting hit from every side. The renter's credit helps people to make up for these and other increasing costs they face. Some of the people that are impacted by these cuts already use social services like food banks, while other people, like Susie, who's here with me today, rely on the renter's credit so that they don't have to rely on those other social services. People like to pay their own way. Folks make choices year-round that others of us don't have to make. They make choices like deciding to eat less food, skipping necessary medications they rely on for their health, or just not making car repairs so that they can make sure that they pay their rent. This tax relief helps to pay for just some of those choices that families and individuals are already making throughout the year just so that they can stay housed. I brought some stories that are being passed out from people that have just written into our office this week. We received about 11 of them yesterday. And a couple of those I'd like to quickly read.
Ms. Goodrich, we're kind of running short on the time here, about 2 minutes for everybody.
Okay. All right, then. Well, I will just hand it off then to Susie Reed, who's here.
And were you referring to the handout that you just handed out?
Yes, sir.
Okay, so members, if you could take a look at that, that'd be great. Please state your name and who you represent for the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Susie Reed, and I live in.
Can you please spell your last name?
R-E-E-D.
Thank you very much. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. I'm a renter, so owning my own home is not a luxury for me. We all know what a battle it has been for homeowners. When thousands were on the verge of losing their homes, the country was in an uproar. You heard from everywhere how unfair it was to them. Their credit, salary, or work history was meaningless to creditors, so perhaps some of you experienced that nightmare yourselves. Relief came to many from the top with securities attached because many homeowners lost their houses to foreclosures. They have helped to fill vacant rentals, causing rents to go up. This is happening to us now, only we are renters, and renters are valuable to the economy as homeowners. We will lose much if the government cut our renter's credit. For myself in the near future, because of my limited income, I have finally found crucial dental treatment in the near future. After adjusting my monthly income, each month I continue to have overdraft fees to repay. If I were to receive $100 less credit in my refund, I will lose this dental coverage that I found. Some people use it to buy expenses like medicines, clothes, school supplies. I finally get the dental coverage I will be able to afford. Minor tooth fillings that has turned into thousands of dollars in porcelain crowns are now crucial to me. This is minor compared to the total repairs that I need for my dental. The credit caps paid many, including myself, strong percentages in independence from the previous year's overflow. Only once each year we get this credit, so this will be devastated if I receive less. To lose this credit, I feel like a homeowner losing my home with the securities attached. I know many who share this here might have that insight as well. So if you cut it, I need it very much, so please, just think of us when you do think of cutting the credit.
Thank you very much, Ms. Reed. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Ms. Reed, and you know, I appreciate the fact that you're sharing what it's like to live on the edge, because I think that's where a lot of people do live, and it's this little cushion that helps to do things like extra, which in a low-income life can be dental care. But one of the provisions in this bill that I'm not sure if you're aware of, but it would actually go back to the renter's credit for rent paid in 2011. And have you filed for your renter's credit already this year?
Not yet. Not yet, because I didn't find the dental that I need. But now that I have, I will file it.
Well, when you file for your renter's credit, usually people do it when they do their income tax forms, it will come to a number that this bill will make less. And it does provide that when you get the check, it'll have an explanation of why the amount is less. But do you think that's going to be disconcerting and make some people mad when the check finally comes and it's less than what you filled out when you filled out your income tax forms?
Oh, yes.
Ms. Reed?
Yes.
Representative Loeffler?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because I think it's important for us to highlight that this isn't just a prospective proposal. It's one that will actually give people less than what they've applied for when they're doing their taxes this year.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Any other questions for Ms. Goodrich or Ms. Reed? Thank you very much for coming today.
Thank you.
Anyone else wish to testify at this point? Otherwise, we'll start getting into amendments. And what would the department prefer? We can have some department testimony now, or maybe after we wrap up all the amendments, then the department could react to what we actually have. Ms. Von Mosch? What would you prefer? We certainly want to give the department the time they need.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. I think what the department would prefer, Commissioner Franz would love to come and spend some time talking with members about what's in the bill, and he is not available today. And if you do go into tomorrow morning, he could be here and share his comments with you then. If you do finish up today, I can share some comments with you, but the commissioner would like to have some time with you if that is possible.
Right, and we'd certainly like to hear from the commissioner also. If by some miracle we were done by noon today, we would certainly want his testimony to be provided to the committee. Would it be okay with the department if we went through the amendments so you would make comments on what we're finally going to be voting on?
Yes, Mr. Chair. That would be preferable if we knew exactly what was in the bill. That would help us tailor
Certainly.
Our comments. I think we know what some of the larger items are, but depending on what happens with the amendment process, we would prefer to comment on the bill as it would look coming out of the committee.
Okay, we will certainly honor that request. Thank you, Ms.
Thank
Von Mosch.
You.
Okay, anyone else to testify? Otherwise, we will be starting with the amendment process. And once we get through that, we'll have members' comments on the bill, and then we will hear from the department, and then we will be voting. So any amendments to the bill? Representative Lincheski.
Mr. Chair, were we going to have this little talk about the new spreadsheet?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I apologize, Representative Lincheski. Absolutely. thank you for that. If we could go through the spreadsheet, who would like to start from House Fiscal? Basically, we're going to be looking at the changes. We've been through the spreadsheet before, just the changes from the bill as amended. Ms. Schill, do you have your voice back a little bit? Or?
Mr. Chair, I'm doing better.
Okay, that's great. If you want to go through the changes.
First of all, yes, Mr. Chair, members, you should be looking at the spreadsheet that in the upper right-hand corner says 315-945. There were two spreadsheets in your packet. I just want to make sure that you're using the most current version. With the addition of the A7 amendment, the spreadsheet has changed. The first two pages look very, very similar to what we discussed the day before yesterday. On the second page, there are two items, numbers 8 and 9, that were added through the A7 amendment. You will see on page 2, item 8, House File 2802, Agricultural Homestead Extension. There is zero impact in H 12 and 13, negligible impact in 14 and 15. And then item 9 is Representative Fabian's reinstatement of the bovine tuberculosis property tax credit. That has a cost of $70,000 in fiscal 13 and a total of, and that would be the same for the biennium, $70,000. And then for 14 and 15, there is a cost of $54,000. The rest of that sheet is the same. Now, if you turn page, both pages 3 and 4 are the remaining bills that were contained within the A7 amendment. As you can see, there are a number of different categories. We have these, but there is no fiscal impact to any state fund on any of these bills. And therefore, Mr. Chair, those are the changes.
Okay, Representative Hartman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question about page 2. It's line 2. It's in the non-general fund. And this might not be new information, but so the elimination of the refund for capital equipment, is the proposal to use legacy funds?
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hortman, that is just interaction with the 3/8 sales tax. Okay. So it's there's just a small revenue loss.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Hortman? Any other questions for House Fiscal, Representative Lancheski?
I don't have a question for House Fiscal.
Okay, any other questions for House Fiscal? Thank you, Ms. Schill and Ms. Templin. Representative Lancheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, the author's amendment, there's no summary of it, and I know you had Mr. Michael walk through it, but if I heard it correctly, there was at least one item that's never, we never heard as a bill in either committee. Is that right? The flooding issue? Is that heard as a bill?
It'd be, I guess there is one issue, the Moorhead exemption. There was not heard in either bill. Maybe we should take a little time to visit about that. Mr. Michael, what page are we looking at?
Mr. Chairman, the provision starts on page 5, line 15, and goes through page 7, line 1.
Can you describe, Mr. Michael, what that does?
Mr. Chairman, it'd probably be better for Mr. Hines to...
Okay, Mr. Hines, could you please join us? Mr. Hines, you can please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, Steve Hines from House Research. Section 23 of the A7 amendment provides for an exemption for new residential structures, a property tax exemption for new residential structures in cities that qualify as being part of a development zone and that were in this flood emergency from, I think, 2009. I'm not sure about that, a recent year. It provides a two-year exemption from property taxes for new homes. And then later on in Subdivision 3 also provides an exemption for improvements to existing residential structures. And in both cases, this program would have to be approved by the city's participation is optional at the choice of the city. And it is not a state-paid exclusion. It's just an exclusion from property taxes. There's a program currently in place that mirrors this program only with regard to new construction, not with improvements, which is a state-paid program. But that program is only in effect through, I believe it's payable 13. So this basically extends that program for two more years, except that it would not be state paid anymore.
Thank you, Mr. Hines. Questions for Mr. Hines, Representative Lancheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I thought I saw Representative Lanning here, and I think he's left again. But Representative Marquardt, I know, is really an expert on this, and this is his area. But it may be so. My question is for Representative Marquardt is, you know, we heard the other bill yesterday that Representative Leader always had for a different area, and I think Representative Peel carried it this year. I'm just trying to understand the differences, and I don't know who's pursuing this, but I'm sure Representative Marquardt can tell us, is this sort of what we've always done, the vanilla sort of assistance?
Representative Marquardt?
Yeah, thank you very much, Mr. Chair, Representative Lancheski. This is really the same bill with some slight modifications that we passed out of taxes in 2009. And what it dealt with, and that was a state-paid credit for any cities that were in border cities that had been impacted by the floods. So it's actually East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, for sure. And then I believe we extended that one year the next year, I think. So I think there was a couple times. But the difference now with this bill is there's no longer a state aid because we realize there are no dollars there. And so what this would do is exempt market value. And the one addition primarily it also deals with new improvements, but it extends that for two more years. And the main reason for that is in 2009, 2010, and 2011, we had three straight floods in the area. And what that has happened, and you can look at, and I know there's folks from Moorhead here that could show that data, but the housing market in new starts just really got soft. I mean, there's just kind of a perception when it's in the news statewide and so forth that you're battling these floods for three straight years. And so this is to try to stay competitive with North Dakota. That was the intent of it. Also, North Dakota does an exemption. Plus, as you know, this year, they have on the ballot a measure two, I believe, that would completely eliminate property taxes in North Dakota, which, you know, if that passed, would really create some competitive. So it's primarily a competitive thing with North Dakota, but also trying to create some incentives after the housing market has been really softened from kind of the perception of these floods. So it's really, other than there's no state money in this, it's what was passed back in 2009, and I think or 10, and we extended it one more year because I think we had to come back and increase that. So it's just an extension of that.
I think what we'll do, that's a very important question Representative Lancheski asked, I think what we'll do is we'll have folks from Moorhead come down. Representative Lanning is here. If you could just come down, make just a few brief comments, and then stand for any questions that members may have of this provision. And members, we're on page 5, starting with 5.15, going through 7, Mr. Michael, or 7.1. Representative Lanning?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members. this is renewing a program that we implemented a couple of years ago for flood-damaged cities to be able to compete for new home construction with our neighbors to the west. And as Representative Marquardt pointed out, the folks in North Dakota have been very aggressive at providing property tax exemption for new construction. And we currently don't have that. That expired at the end of 2011. And so what we're trying to do is to renew that for the next 2 years to be able to compete. And I have to tell you, folks, if the North Dakota voters eliminate their property tax, we're in a world of hurt along the North Dakota border. Can you imagine trying to attract any housing development at all, and even sell existing homes if North Dakota doesn't have a property tax? And Yeah, that's a pretty scary thing. And so we would ask for your support, enable us to continue this for another 2 years to be able to at least have some opportunity to compete with our neighbors to the west.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Lanning. I think he's Representative Marquardt and Representative Lanning have described it very well. And we have a couple resource people here. If we have questions that they need to answer, that's fine. We'll go to Representative Anderson, then Downey. Representative Anderson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Lanning, and to the folks from the City of Moorhead. I appreciate you coming here. And, you know, I know when we had some conversations in years past of different policies that were passed here at the legislature, from the smoking ban issue in our bars and restaurants to the raising the gas tax. Can you just kind of tell me a little bit of what those taxes, what kind of impact they've had on your communities, and especially when you're right next to North Dakota?
Can you please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir?
Mr. Chair and members, Michael Redlinger, Redlinger, City Manager, City of Moorhead.
Welcome
today
to the committee, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
How are those spuds doing?
hopefully well. Game tonight in Crookston, so.
Okay.
But
I'm going to say good luck, but that could get me in trouble, so I'll just may the best team win.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for the question. Of course, the border disparities are always one that, as Representative Lanning noted, as well as Representative Marquardt, when you talk about property taxes, you talk about the gas tax and other matters, that equity is very, very important. And we've seen a state that next door that certainly is a formidable competitor, a state that is investing in its local communities, and in particular, local community, our direct neighbor, our partner, but also our competitor for new housing starts in Moorhead, is also really putting a strong front and a good face on housing growth in North Dakota. The housing starts and the data we can provide to the committee would suggest that we're just not seeing that level of investment that we had seen prior to the Great Recession in 2008. We had some very strong permit numbers in 2006 and 2007. We actually grew by nearly 6,000 residents between the 2000 and 2010 census, which were great numbers for us, some of the largest gains ever in the community's history. But we are very concerned that repetitive flooding has left this community in a very difficult position, in a position where everything that we are doing with our K-12 education systems, higher education, are all there. They're all very good things. But it's a competitive marketplace, and this is a tool that we would like to put before the City Council for their affirmative action so that they can again, invest in housing and do everything that we can to incent that type of growth and development in the community. So, but equity is important, competition is important, and having the tools to do the job and grow our community again and get back on track is really what we're looking to do.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Redlinger. I appreciate your input on that. And, you know, I'm guessing, you know, we're discussing as part of our overall package here to eliminate the business property tax that we have in the state. I'm guessing that would certainly help your efforts in competing against North Dakota. Can you speak to that a little bit, please?
Mr. Redlinger.
Mr. Chair and members, this is a particular matter when you talk about business taxation issues between the two states that have been paramount. The legislature has been incredibly supportive on the Board of Cities legislation over the past years to keep us on a level playing field. And so there are several strategies that we need to employ in the future to remain competitive with our neighbors to the west.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Redlinger, can you give me an idea, ballpark figure, of how many businesses you think that you have lost to North Dakota because of our tax structure within the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Redlinger.
Mr. Chair and members, without the data in front of us, it would be hard to peg a number, but as Representative Lanning, then Mayor Lanning, through the 1980s and 1990s would recall, we did lose several businesses from Minnesota that did leave for North Dakota, but if the committee is interested, we'd be happy to provide the data.
Representative Anderson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Redlinger, that would be wonderful if you could. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Redlinger. And would the other gentleman like to introduce himself and what's your capacity as the City of Moorhead?
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Scott Hutchins, Community Services Director for the City of Moorhead.
Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Other questions for the testifier? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just curious, what is the current property tax environment in North Dakota? They don't have a statewide property tax, is that right? So this is a initiative referendum to actually get rid of all property local property taxes. Could you just describe what's currently there and what it would look like after?
Mr. Redlinger?
Mr. Chair and members, as noted by Representative Lanning, this is an initiated measure that would remove property taxes in North Dakota. Some real deleterious impacts, of course, to the local taxing jurisdictions, including the school districts, the counties, and the cities. If you were to replace those revenues, it would not be done easily, and it would not be done without some incredible impacts to sales taxes as well as other forms of taxation. And I know that's one particular reason that the local Chamber of Commerce, the Fargo-Moorhead-West Fargo Chambers, come out in opposition to that particular measure, but it is something that we're in tune with and something that we're tracking closely.
Bruce M. Downey?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And what's the comparison on sales tax between your respective regions, Moorhead and Fargo?
Mr. Redlinger?
Mr. Chair and members, there is a two local option sales taxes in the city of Fargo. There's a Cass County tax in North Dakota, as well as a flood mitigation and infrastructure tax in the city of Fargo. So relative to the Minnesota side, there is a higher level of taxation.
Bruce M. Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I don't know if Representative Lanning wants to comment. Gosh, you guys are against the eight ball even as it is, and if this thing passes...
Well,
Representative Lanning?
thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Downey, currently Fargo, which has local option taxes that we don't have in Moorhead, is a little bit higher. They're at 7%. They're looking at the possibility of renewing one of the taxes that expires this summer that would keep them a little bit higher. But I wish that the fact that we didn't tax clothing helped us more with retail development than it does. But you know, the income tax comparisons between Minnesota and North Dakota and the business property taxes, the business taxes that they have in North Dakota work to our disadvantage in competing for businesses.
Representative Downey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Paymar, then Carlson. Representative Paymar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Rettlinger or Representative Lanning, Representative Anderson was talking about the competitive disadvantage between North Dakota and western Minnesota. And you spoke to that. Then can I assume, or would you say that you support the elimination of the CI property tax, and that you also support doing that by cutting $70 million out of the renter's credit? Mr. Redlinger?
Mr. Redlinger?
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, we'll stay silent on that for today, but no, we're here just in support of the exemption today. So.
Representative Paymar?
Well, I mean, Mr. Rettlinger, if you're going to support a bill, and Representative Anderson asked you about these competitive disadvantages, either you support it or you don't. I mean, that's the way we fund getting rid of the CI business property tax.
Mr. Redlinger?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and members, and again, our city council has not discussed that matter in particular, so I wouldn't have the authority to speak to that item, but again, we're here in support of the exemption piece today and try to get our housing starts back on track.
Mr. Chair, and Representative Lanning, do you support the bill in its current form?
Representative Lanning?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, this proposal for a property tax exemption for new construction in flood-damaged cities does not affect the state's budget. You're not going to have to come up with some money to cover this. What it would allow us to do is to grant the exemption at the local level.
Mr. Chair, maybe I'm going off that. Maybe it's a question you don't want to answer, but I'm not talking about this particular proposal. I'm talking about the bill that phases out the CI tax for business and industry and uses the renter's credit to fund that.
Well, Representative Paymar, that'll be for us to decide. That's not the issue that we're on.
No, Representative Anderson was asking questions of representatives from that community. That's the bill we're talking about. You don't have to answer, Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Paymar, Minnesota's commercial industrial property taxes have been a disincentive for commercial development, for job creation in Minnesota. That's an issue that we need to address. How we pay for it is the tax committee's decision to make.
Representative Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, members, I happen to serve and have for many years on the Midwest Higher Education Commission, and it's virtually every state in the Midwest, including Minnesota and the Dakotas. And we've had a lot of discussions there about the unique situation that North Dakota is in, and it's the oil revenue. They're able to accomplish a whole lot, generate huge surpluses and so on because they've got oil in the state. And the other thing is that they do get, due to the military installations there, they get a lot of federal dollars that are flowing in. I'm told that we get about 72 cents on the dollar that goes to Washington, and they get about $1.85 back. So there are a lot of issues that are somewhat beyond our control. I think we have to be responsive as best we can, but I think we should understand what the situation is. And I do have a question of Representative Lanning. I know you're retired now, but you were at a private institution, but you were involved with higher education. Mm-hmm. And what's happening relative to issues like reciprocity and Minnesota students, because in recent years, we've unfortunately cut higher education in the state of Minnesota, and we've become a high-tuition state. Our community colleges are among the most expensive in the whole United States of America, and the University of Minnesota has become, relative to their peers in the Big Ten, with the exception of Northwestern, which is a private institution, very expensive to attend. And what's happening with enrollment, if you happen to know, at North Dakota State, with their revenue to keep tuition in check and what have you, because there are just a lot of issues here that when you've got those oil wells makes competition difficult.
Members, if we could please focus our comments to the issue at hand, but Representative Lanning, if you want to answer that, I'd really like to talk about the bill, page 5, lines 515 through 7.1. Representative Lanning.
Mr. Chairman, before he answers, I basically concur, but like Representative Paymar, we didn't open the door to this discussion, and it's an important one, and being that the door was opened, I think we should arrive at some understandings as to what is creating a competitive disadvantage, and as a state, we may have to choose to somehow respond to some of these issues. As was pointed out by the city manager, historically, we have responded in a variety of ways, but the game has changed relative to North Dakota because of the development of oil. Not too many years ago, the oil wells in North Dakota were not competitive. Today, with higher gas prices, they are now very competitive, and we have a state that's just booming as a result. In fact, they have a worker shortage in those areas because they're just sinking one oil well after another. And I didn't open the door. Representative Paymar didn't open the door. Your folks did in terms of trying to put Minnesota in a bad light. What I'm trying to say is we should have, if we're going to have the discussion, a bit of balance between that discussion and an understanding of what's happening. And I don't have a solution here. I'm just saying we're going to have to probably respond some way. We do have to figure out a way to help our border states, our border communities.
President Carlson, can you please use the microphone? Otherwise, you're not.
Well, we do have to figure out a way to help our border communities, I was saying, but I think we have to understand what's causing the competitive disadvantage.
Representative Lanning?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Carlson, without getting into a higher education discussion here, let me just say this. Tuition has had to go up at North Dakota State University. The folks at North Dakota State University have been saying for a long time the state has not been funding higher education like they need to, in spite of the fact that they've got oil revenues that are skyrocketing. We're losing too many students from Minnesota to North Dakota institutions, and that is costing us. We're having to pay more to North Dakota than they're paying to us on the reciprocity. And that's a concern for a number of reasons. We're losing students. It's costing us. So this is not the oil hasn't been the boon to higher education like maybe some people might think.
Representative Carlson?
Well, I was interested in getting that answer because it It has been a discussion with the Midwest Higher Education Commission frequently, not so much at the level of what tuition is, but just the huge advantages in a variety of ways North Dakota has because of the oil revenue.
Okay, thank you. There's some Carl Sorensen, Marquardt.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I know the folks from Moorhead are here to testify on Section 23 of the author's amendment. But, you know, the property taxes is the key. And the city of Moorhead does an excellent job of putting together a comparison of an average homeowner in Moorhead versus an average homeowner in Fargo. And I don't have that with me, but every year they send that out. And when you add up everything, income taxes, sales taxes, property taxes, housing values, and so forth, it's almost identical. It is very, very competitive. And what allows it to be competitive is our lower property taxes, actually, than the North Dakota side. So the North Dakota side does not put as much dollars into education. So there's more local effort on the education side in North Dakota. And so this section in the bill is highly critical to keeping those property taxes in check. And it's very limited. It only deals with cities that are in border cities, which we have already said are at some sort of a competitive disadvantage with North Dakota. East Grand Forks, Moorhead, Dilworth, Breckenridge, and I think Ortonville's in there. And then besides that, it also has to have had a presidential declaration of flooding. And I know there's some of us around here who have experienced these flooding. And it is not only the physical as far as the dollars that are spent fighting these, but there is a psychological impact on not only residents within the community, but people outside looking in. And if these areas are going to stay competitive with North Dakota, and that's even before there's a possibility of this Measure 2 being passed, this is crucial. And it's an extension basically of what we've had, except there's no state dollars. I mean, we realize that, and there's no state dollars in this. And so, members, I would ask that you support this. It is vital to these areas that are experiencing flood. Thank goodness this year we're not going to have to battle that. But in the last 3 years, we have had the highest flood peak on the Red River. That was 2009. I think the next year was like fourth, and the next year was like sixth. We've had like three in the top all-time eight going back to history in just the last 3 years. And that has had, and you know, if you head into Moorhead and look at all the work that's been done there, you know, using the bonding dollars and that, it's been phenomenal. I mean, they are making that city, it's going to be just up to a 100-year flood, it's going to be sitting really good. And I want to mention one other thing, and they haven't mentioned, but just yesterday, there was a major fire in Moorhead that I think it's going to be a total loss of a factory that employs over 100 people in Moorhead. And that just happened yesterday. Yes. And so you know, so we don't get a flood this year, we get a fire. And so members, I know it's just for a few cities and that, but it is vital to this area of Minnesota.
Thank you, Representative Marquardt. Representative Rukavina, and then Luncheski. Representative Rukavina.
Well, Mr. Chair, I got to tell you, you are such a good chair. You let us get off on tangents, and since we're on one, you know, and I want to welcome the folks from up in the Northwest on, but, you know, Representative Carlson, I remind you, we got a lot of mineral wealth in this state. Problem is, we're having a hard time trying to develop it. You know, I might remind you that this year and for several years past and in the future, the University of Minnesota is getting $11.5 million a year in Taconite royalties from Kiewaukon Taconite. Now, if Pinky McNamara, I don't know if that's Representative McNamara's brother or uncle or whatever, but was going to give $11 million a year to the university, President Kaler would probably jump off the roof of the new Gopher Stadium. But it's kind of like we're all embarrassed to talk about it. You know, since I established the Iron Range Scholarship with that mineral royalty, it's become the biggest scholarship at the University of Minnesota and has given over $27 million. And it pales in comparison to what's out there in copper nickel. So keep that in mind because we do have all kinds of wealth. But to my friends from up in the northwest part of the state, I have to remind you too, since we're talking about competitiveness, about the old nonpartisan league, you know, with the farmer labor movement. And they got a state workers' compensation fund. They got a state bank in North Dakota.
They got socialism. It's working great in North Dakota. It's working great out there. We should have some of that stuff to compete. So, you know, I guess I'm off on a tangent, and thank you, Mr.
Thank you, I think. Since your name was mentioned, Representative Carlson.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I was just going to ask Representative Rukavina if he remembers who helped him get that scholarship program going.
Representative Rukavina?
Mr. Chair, I do remember that, and but it could have been a hell of a lot bigger right now. That's all.
Well, I thought you might want to acknowledge who that person is.
That guy right over there.
Representative Lencheski.
Mr. Chair, I have a question after we're done with the flooding issue for staff before we would start amendments. I'll just wait.
Okay, you are on the list, Representative Lencheski. Any other questions for Representative Lanning or the gentleman from either the gentleman from Moorhead regarding page 5, section 5.15 to page 7, 7.1? Thank you, Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Gentlemen, thank you for coming from Moorhead. Okay. Now, before we get into amendments, we will go to Representative Lencheski's question.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have a handout if a page pass this out. And, Mr. Chair, I'm just recalling for the committee, I had asked for a formal request that tax committee members see an expanded spreadsheet of what this bill costs. And Ms. Templin did prepare it for us, and I was hoping she could just take a minute to talk to us about it. I made that request at the last full committee hearing.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Let's give the pages a second to pass it off, Ms. Templin, before we start. Okay, I have one. We can start.
No.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair.
We don't all have
it,
Mr. Chair.
Oh, okay. Hold
we don't
on.
Have it. Mr. Chair,
Representative,
well, it's being passed out. I just got it too. I have, you know, seen it here live. So I mean, there's, we're I have one.
Okay, we will wait until all members have the revised spreadsheet. Let me just wait a second. Here we go. Templin, I believe everybody has a copy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You should have a spreadsheet that says House File 2337DE1, and it shows the, on the first page, tax revenues. It shows the projected tax revenues within the forecast period for fiscal 12 through fiscal 15. And that is what is in the bill, or what was in the bill before the author's amendment. And then you see on the right hand of the spreadsheet a section that is outside the forecast period from fiscal 16 to fiscal 19. I will be just focusing on the outside forecast period. This is, again, a very rough ballpark estimate of what the revenues would be for the bill after fiscal 15. Basically, for some of these provisions to project what the number would be, I just flatlined the fiscal 15 number through fiscal 19. Or if the bill had language about what the tax revenue change should be after fiscal 15, that number is in this spreadsheet. So just very quickly, looking at tax revenues for the first line, replacing the FOC credit deduction with a tax credit in fiscal 16 and 17 and 18 and 19, the biennial number is $41 million. For replacing the R&D credit, the biennial total, I'll just focus on fiscal 18 and 19 just to kind of accelerate things, is $43 million. For the technology corporate franchise tax certificate transfer program, the revenue reduction is $60 million. Moving on to line 5, the jobs tax credit qualified for qualified veterans, the estimated revenue reduction is $3 million. On line 6, the alcohol beverage taxes, the estimated revenue reduction is $800 million. Ms. Schill.
$800,000.
$800,000. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That would be quite expensive.
And, Mr. Chair, members, item number 8 is the statewide property tax. If you recall, the first year fiscal 13 reflects 6 months worth of reduction in the tax, and then you get your full year impact in fiscal 14 and going beyond that. Also in fiscal 14, you'll notice that the phase out, the 12-year levy phase out begins, and so you can see once you get to fiscal 14 and 15, that impact is $316.4 million, and it increases thereafter. For fiscal 16 and 17, you are at a total of, and I want to make sure I also include the interactions here, you're at a total of $580 million. And then for fiscal 18 and 19, you're at a total of $833.5 million. Total tax revenue changes, therefore, in the outside the forecast period for all revenue items, fiscal 16 and 17, a revenue loss of just shy of $675 million. And for fiscal 18 and 19, a revenue loss of $899 million.
Any questions for
on page two,
okay.
We have the extension for property tax aids and credits. And basically here, you can see on item one is where most of the changes reflected. This is the reduction to the renter property tax refund. Basically, how these numbers were arrived was that there's an approximate 8% factor involved with the change between fiscal and 14, and I just extended that for each of the years thereafter. So for fiscal 16 and 17. It looks like the column headings are a little bit off. Yeah, for fiscal 15, 16 and 17, the total reduction in the renter property tax refund would be just shy of $179 million. And then for fiscal, 18 and 19, that is approximately $208.6 million. The totals for all those changes in fiscal 16 and 17 would be a reduction of $178.4 million, and in 18 and 19 it would be $208.1 million.
Any questions for Ms. Templer and Ms. Schill? I've got a list. Templer and Ms. Schill. I've got a list for Lincheski Law for Horpin, Representative Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr.
Questions for the fiscal.
Yes. Oh. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just looking at the bottom number, and the second page, very last number in the right corner. I mean, the way I'm understanding it, and we know things aren't static. You know, future things, legislatures make future choices, but this bill to me reads as, you know, we're going to get rid of the business tax cuts. We're going to have the renters pay for a couple hundred million of the $900 million price tag. And then someday in the future, some other legislature is going to cut another $700 million somewhere else or raise taxes of $700 million. So it's sort of a built-in deficit. And I just want to make sure, asking Ms. Templin, is the 691, again, understanding a lot of these things move around and there's no way to know for sure. But is that what that final number is saying? Is all the changes in the bill means by the time everything's fully phased in,
we're missing $691 million per, is it per year or biennium? Biennium, I guess.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lencheski, based on these assumptions, based on what is in the bill, the net in fiscal 18 with changes to the general fund is estimated to be minus $691.1 million.
Representative Lencheski. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to Ms. Schill, you know, since there's a 12-year phase-out of the statewide property tax, and this just takes us to fiscal year 19, it shows some pretty major growth from starting out at, you know, 40,000 to 194,000 to FY 2019. It's 450 million, excuse me. And do we have, or did you, were you able to get from revenue an estimate of what this would be, the full cost after the 12-year phase-in is put in? I mean, I know you'd have to make some assumptions, but you know, it would be nice to know what that full 12-year cost of this particular item is, since it's the item that's growing the fastest.
Ms. Schill?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, first of all, and we've advised before, Department of Revenue will provide revenue estimates for the current biennium and then the ensuing biennium. They will not provide revenue estimates for this beyond the 14 and 15 biennium. So that is part of the reason why Ms. Templin and I did the outside the forecast period here. So first of all, our friends at Department of Revenue will not go that far out. But it is easy to calculate then for a 12-year finite period exactly how much money would be required to phase out the entire CI property tax. And so it's right in the sense right here we have up through fiscal 18 and 19 the override statewide property tax phase out would be 12 years, so that would be 2026, and that is not shown on this particular sheet. But the idea is to erase the entire CI property tax.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm wondering if to get to that impact, we could just have the base budget of what the current statewide levy is right now on CI property. It wouldn't have the inflators that will happen over the next 12 years, but we would at least have sort of a present value of what the total package is. And I don't know if you have that or if Mr. Hines has that, but I would think that would give us some idea. You'd have to add inflation through those whole 12 years, but.
Ms. Schill? Or Mr. Hines?
Mr. Hines.
Ms. Schill?
Can I just say from here right now that the statewide business.
Why don't you join us up here, Mr. Hines? Mr. Hines?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Loeffler, currently the statewide CI tax is at about $780 million. This bill also phases out the seasonal rec part, which is around $40 million. So it's about $820 for the full elimination per year. And, of course, there's inflation added to that each year. So, but just on a present value or the present number is $820.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, members. I think that's really important. And, you know, I think if once you added the inflation in, you'd easily get over $1 billion here of property tax relief that isn't funded into the future. It's got a down payment with the renter's credit. But I think if we think about it in terms of that number, we're talking a major amount of financial obligation into the future beyond this chart. But I really appreciate you putting together this chart for the period you could do it.
Thank you, Representative Loeffler. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Which of the fiscal staff. I understand that the way the columns work here, where it says fiscal 12 and 13, you have in each year, and then that third column that says fiscal year 12 and 13 is cumulative of just those two prior years. And so in order to figure out the total cost on this chart of the cutting corporate taxes, you would have to add the number from the fiscal year 12 and 13, the 14, 15, the 16, 17, and the 18, 19 together. Is that the right way to look at
it? Or Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair and Representative Portman, I believe the question is if you want to find out what the changes are to the corporate tax base revenues. Yes, roughly corporate taxes raise about $900 billion in gross receipts. And then there are a couple provisions in this bill. You see that the biennial amounts for fiscal 12, for example, reduces corporate tax revenues by 25.7 million. So that would be, again, deducted from the corporate tax receipts of $1 billion.
Department.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, then looking at line 8, when I do just quick math and I add those numbers up across the, well, actually it wasn't line 8, it's the one, the total tax revenue changes on the bottom, I get a cumulative cost on page 1 of 2.023 billion. And I know this doesn't have the full phase, and what I should have actually done. And let me just see if this is what I did do. No, what I was looking for is the number of how much we're cutting corporate taxes. I wanted to get that number. But I think it's right around $2 billion. But when I add up the amount of tax increases on the poor people on line 1 on page 2, if you add the $66 million in the present biennium, $153 million in the next biennium, then $178 million, I mean, as if they have any money left by that point, right? And then the $208 million in 14 and 15, we're raising taxes on poor people by $607 million. So $607,055 million in tax increases on poor people. So I just wondered if I was adding the numbers right in terms of looking at the chart, because the gray bar is just cumulative for the 2 years preceding it. All right.
Ms. Temple?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Ms. Hartman? Or some Carlson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I want to make a comment or two, but I first have a question of staff. You know, we passed out of here the other day, and we'll have up on the floor this afternoon the K-12 finance bill. And when I look at 13 here, the second page, the negative number, and if you were to combine the K-12 bill cost on buying down the shift an additional $400 million with the negative number we have here, where do our reserves and cash flow accounts end up?
Ms. Templin?
If one of the staff could address that. I've got my own thoughts on that, but probably should get a professional input.
Mr. Chair, with the Mr. Chair and Representative Carlson. Oh, good. I think you're referring to the negative $3.5 million in the bill before it was amended, and that total relative to what the K-12 minority report, offered. You're looking for a total?
No, I'm not talking about the minority report. Mr. Chairman, Ms. Templin, I'm talking about the bill that Representative Garofalo has going through the process that will be debated on the House floor. The minority report, unfortunately, was tabled.
Ms. Templin?
Mr. Chair, Representative Carlson, yes, that Representative Garofalo's bill, I think it was 2083. That used the budget reserved for the shifts, and that I don't have that total number in my head right now, but that would be, if that passed, that would, and if this bill passed, yes, there would be a negative at the bottom.
Yeah, and, Carlson.
Mr. Chairman, I have a question of you. I know the Ways and Means Committee, and you and I both serve on it, has never addressed the question of a budget resolution this year or a target. So have you informally been given a target, and how are you coordinating these tax cuts plus expenditures with the other major funding bills that are going through the process, that the K-12 one being the biggest one with $400 million in addition to what under current law would be being paid back to buy down the shift. And as I pointed out on the floor the other day, you know, I was in agreement with trying to buy down the shift. The question was whether we paid for that buying down the shift or not. So the question of you, do you have informally a target, and did Representative Garofalo have a target? I mean, what road are we on here? The Commissioner of Finance, or OMB, pointed out the other day that with just the Garofalo bill, we were going to have major cash flow problems. And now we piggyback this one on top of it. And then we did get, I think all of us that are involved with fiscal issues, the cash flow report day before yesterday from OMB, and that showed that already we were a negative 1 month, flat out negative relative to cash flow, and in addition to that, it showed that like 6 of the next 7 months we were at risk of having cash flow problems. And for members that don't follow that part of it as much as some of us do, that means OMB is going to have to engage in short-term borrowing. Now, that's just to get us through this year and with current law, exactly. And then if we start talking about the huge deficit that we're being left with beginning next biennium, which is $1.1 billion under the February forecast, and then if you talk about the shift and what's owed to the school districts, you have to add $2.2 billion to that. That brings us to $3.3 billion. And then if you adjust even for a very modest inflationary increase, or if case loads go up, you know, those kinds of issues that we sometimes have to deal with enrollments, you're probably talking about over a $4 billion problem next biennium that is now being added to with this bill. Now, the Garofalo bill at that point is one-time spending. It's taking cash from this biennium, but your bill then adds to the difficulty we already have with the deficit next biennium. So, Mr. Chairman, I go back. I talked a long time in terms of asking you the question, but do you have a target? Is there a coordination between you and at least the K-12 people?
Well, thank you, Representative Carlson, for that question. A lot of your question has to do with issues that we talked about in Ways and Means, because I'm not going to get into what education is doing and what this one's. What we're looking at, I am authorized at this point to move forward with the bill that we have before us, and I can't speak. The question you ask basically is a question for Ways and Means, and I'm sure we'll hear it there too. I can't answer at this point for what the other moving parts are doing.
Well, Mr.
For
Chairman,
Carlson,
you know, the role of Ways and Means is to set a target, and that hasn't happened. And sometimes, I know I've been here a lot of years. In fact, I was here before we even had a Ways and Means Committee, and the targets were back in those days set informally. But we always had, whether your party was in control or our party was in control, you either had a target informally in place or you had a formal budget resolution that came under Speaker Jennings. In recent years, I was quite involved with the Speaker and with the Chair of the Tax Committee and so on. We worked on setting those targets so that every division that was involved with the finance or an appropriations bill or the tax committee, we all knew what the game plan was and what the ultimate goal was to balance a budget in the end. And that's not happening this year. We're spending down the surplus then under these two bills. And I think, you know, in case they become law, these are issues that we have to talk about and where we're where we're headed. I guess it's a bit unfortunate that we're just kind of doing these things on the fly and there's no coordination, no targets being set. It's just raising a question of whether or not we have good fiscal management or not.
Thank you, Representative Carlson. Representative Loon?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I wanted to ask a couple of questions and then also offer some of my own comments on some of the points that have been raised. I guess the first, and maybe staff could clarify, but to Representative Hortman's comments, with the exception of perhaps number one, on, again, on the backside of the spreadsheet, and perhaps number three, these tax credits or tax policies that we're debating are not all pertaining to corporations. Isn't that correct? And I don't know who wants to answer
Ms.
that.
Templin.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loon, yes, that is correct. Lines 1 through 5 affect individual income and corporate franchise taxes.
Thank you. Yes, because many businesses, many small businesses in particular, are not organized as a C corporation under our tax statute. So we are not just talking about corporations. We are talking about the little mom-and-pop coffee shop, especially when you talk about CI, statewide property tax. We're talking about lots of different types of businesses, and in most cases, small businesses. And the other thing I wanted to ask about now, so for those businesses, and again, this would apply to individuals that pay property tax, do they have to pay this statewide property tax whether or not that business is profitable?
Ms. Templin or Ms. Schell?
Excuse me, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, Representative Loon.
Give me one or the other.
You can nod your head.
I'm just trying to talk. Yes, they would have to pay property tax.
Thank you. Thank you, and I'm so sorry to make you speak. If I didn't work out a signal with you, I'm sorry. It sounds painful. All right, so I just wanted to point that out, and a couple of things to the forecast questions that were asked, because again, we're talking about taxes that businesses pay, whether they're profitable or not. This doesn't get to their profit; it's how much money they're making. This is property taxes, and we have a lot of good debates about that, So that's one point. Another point about that is, when we talk about forecasts, and we don't forecast revenues out. We get, our forecast twice a year, and that the revenues are not projected out to fiscal year 18 and 19 and that. We try to look out, in the tails or another couple of years, but we don't know. Things happen. I mean, I came into this body in 09 and in the heels of what had started to be one of the worst recessions our state had seen, and it's my understanding that in the previous legislature there was, when they came into charge, there was perhaps $2 billion of revenues left by their predecessors, and that was all gone, and we came into about a $5 billion deficit my first term in the legislature in 09, so things happen and things change. They also change for the better, so it's hard to know. But we don't forecast when we talk about these things what would happen for those businesses if we would remove this gradually, this statewide property tax on our businesses. What would happen with that money? And again, if staff could clarify. And we've had these debates about dynamic scoring and that, but we don't put any accounting into our forecast about whether or not a small business that eventually is not paying that statewide property tax, if they would add a couple of employees to their payroll. There's no accounting for that in any of our official forecasts, is there?
Ms. Templin or Ms. Schell?
Mr. Chair and Representative Loon, what we're doing on the spreadsheet is actually tracking as the change in law requires the phase out of the property tax that currently exists. What a business does with that money when they don't pay it, I can't speak to at all.
Okay, thank you. And again, I won't make you talk anymore on that, but just again to make the point, we track one part of the equation, but we don't track the other side of it. So if a business does take that money and add a couple of more employees to their payroll, people who are working and paying taxes, we don't account for that economic activity. Nor do we take into account whether that business decides to reduce the cost of goods and services that they offer to their customers, whether they be renters or homeowners or any other type of consumer. And you know, I don't know if any of the business people wanted to talk about this.
But she's
you know,
see,
but
you've been as I have on council.
You know, I think that's a point to be made, and we talk about progressive taxes and regressive taxes. Taxes that fall to businesses are regressive because they pass those taxes on to the people who buy their goods or their services. Okay, they're ultimately paid by the consumers, and that hits to the good people that we heard from today who are renters concerned about their credit. All of these taxes that we pile upon businesses thinking that we're helping those people, they just raise the price of the goods and services that we turn around and give people a credit to use that money to pay for those things. So, you know, I just think we need to be sure that we're talking about this with the full scope of what these things imply.
Okay, with that, I have a Downey Drazkowski Carlson. But what we're going to do, members, as you can see the clock, I think if we had five more minutes, we could probably vote on the bill. But it's just we're that close. It's just not going to happen. So tomorrow, 10 o'clock, we meet in room 200. We will. I've got my list here. We'll go Downey Drazkowski Carlson. I would like to, we will get into amendments. Once the amendments, the final bill is done and we're out of amendments, what we'll be doing then is hearing from the Department of Revenue. We want to hear from the Department of Revenue, and I think it'd be appropriate once we know where we're at, then the department can comment on what is actually there. With that, member Representative Hartman.
Mr. Chair, I would make you an offer. I will bring donuts if you will bring coffee.
At 10 o'clock?
At 10 o'clock.
I think that can be arranged.
Bring donuts.
We'll make it work. With that, members, and we will be voting on the bill tomorrow as amended. Good government all the time. We are adjourned.